As we look at our economic times today, we think it is a catastrophe, but it has not yet reached the depths of what is known as our Great Depression. What we have right now is a serious recession, and every time we turn on the news, there's something new to be concerned about. We find out about this scandal or that scandal or the other scandal. Thinking back to 1929, in looking at the actual event that triggered the stock market crash, they allowed the purchase of stock with only a 10% down. In other words, 90% could be taken on margin or on credit. And so that created an interesting situation because people would put down their 10%, and then if the stock happened to go up 10%, they doubled their money. They did just fine. On the other hand, what happens if the stock goes down 10% from the point that they bought it? Well, now the amount that they owe ends up being more than the amount that the stock could be sold for. And so, therefore, their brokerage house would tell them, well, if you want to hold on to the stock after it had dropped, say, 5%, they would require them to come up with 5%. And the difficulty that ensued from that was that it wasn't long and people were needing to sell their shares in order to cover their losses. And when you have everyone trying to sell, guess what happens to the price of stock? Well, there were a couple of people that came to the rescue. And they opened up shop down the street, Bernard Baruch and Rockefeller and Carnegie, and they were trying to buy up all the stock. They thought, well, you know, this was a good opportunity to buy stock at bargain basement prices. And they tried to do so for about 2 days, and then they realized that they couldn't cover the market. And the market crashed. David, as he's writing Psalm 11, is writing about a period of time in Israel's history where everything was falling apart in Israel. It fell apart so badly that his advisors were saying, you can't stay here in Jerusalem. You need to run away to Masada. And David said, I put my trust in the Lord. And what his advisors said was, your Lord hasn't done anything. We need to go. And David is writing this psalm in order to help his advisors get their advice straight. He's helping them come through a time when they were panicking. Let's take a look more closely at this psalm. The heading is To the Chief Musician, a Psalm of David. So this is meant to be sung in the worship services of Israel. David is the composer. Now, as you look at verses 1 through 3, we will need to look very closely at the punctuation. In particular, we will be looking at where the quotation marks are. So if you read most texts, it will read as the first set of notes for this verse. In the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, quote, flee as a bird to your mountain, end quote. So in verse 1, David starts out and he quotes his advisors. But then in verse 2, since that's not part of the quote, it is seen as a resumption of David speaking. For look, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow on the string, that they may shoot secretly at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? It doesn't really make sense for verses 2 and 3 to be David's words. They are instead the words of his advisors, and he is quoting them. So the corrected punctuation does not have a close quote at the end of verse 1, but the quote goes all the way through the end of verse 3. In the Lord I put my trust. How can you say, flee as a bird to your mountain? And here's what else they say. For look, David, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow on the string, that they may shoot secretly at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? They are seeking to bolster their argument that David needs to flee and he cannot trust in the Lord. And so that's what verses 2 and 3 were designed to do. They were designed to convince David that he could not trust in the Lord. And what David is saying is, how can you say this to me? How's that for advice? I wonder what kind of advice our president and our governor are getting these days. I wonder if it's godly advice. I wonder if it's from people who understand the word. I have a suspicion a number of David's men had understood the word, but during times of crisis, they showed themselves not to be trusting the Lord. David needed to straighten out his advisors. Now, let's consider the relationship between verses 1 and 3 and 4 through 7. Verses 4 through 7 in this passage are David's answer. Verses 4 through 7 explain why David will not take the advice of his advisors. It is the reason that he continues to trust in the Lord. Now, nothing in the psalm tells us exactly when this is, but it could well be during the time of Absalom. I don't think that David is saying that it's wrong to go to a safe place like Masada. As you remember, during the Absalom revolt, he did leave Jerusalem because he realized that if he stayed, that there would be many innocent people that would be killed if the battleground were within the city. So the objection that David has to his advisor's advice is they're saying you can't trust in God because he isn't doing anything and he won't do anything. Notice where he starts the psalm in verse 1a. In the Lord I have taken refuge. That would be a more literal rendering of this. But putting one's trust is the same concept. David is saying that this is settled. For him, it does not matter what the circumstances are. He knows that God has made promises to him that he will keep. And David is able to take refuge in the Lord. He doesn't need an earthly refuge. He does not need to put his trust in his military prowess or in the location. He's ultimately trusting in the Lord. So now he says to his advisors, 1b through c, how can you say to my soul? Now I'd like for you to notice the word you is plural. So he's talking to his advisors. This is how we reach this determination. Notice the word soul is feminine. That's going to be important. So then as you look at the second part of verse 1b, when it says, you fly as a bird to your mountain, this is what they've said to David, soul or life, or that is David, but the word soul is feminine, and that's the reason the word you in the second part of the verse is feminine. Fly as a bird to your mountain. And the your there would be a reference to that which belongs to David and his military as being those who were in power in Israel. So David saying to them, "How can you tell me? Fly like a bird to your mountain." How can he say? How can they say to him, "Flee in panic"? Now David is quoting his advisors, and they are going to give their reason for this advice that they have given to David. In verse 2, "For look, the wicked tread the bow." Now literally, this is that the wicked are stepping on their bow because the long bow had to be strung with the help of the foot in order to be able to get the string all the way onto the bow. "And they make ready their arrow on the string, that they may shoot in darkness," that is, secretly, "the upright in heart ones." They are making plans to attack. And whether the attacks are always going to be physical or whether it's going to be partially through slander, we're not entirely sure. But notice it's being done in secret. David, at this point, doesn't really know who he can trust and who he can't trust, and so the issue is, okay, let's get away from the larger groups of people, let's cut down the numbers, let's get into a place that's easy to protect so we don't need to have a lot of people, and that way, David, you and we will be as safe as we could possibly be. Why is it that they are in such a panic? Verse 3. "If the foundations of society are destroyed," as our translation reads, "what can the righteous do?" Now, when you look at that word righteous, are you thinking singular? Or are you thinking plural? The way that the text is set up, when they didn't capitalize it, they're pointing us towards, what can righteous people do? We're helpless. We have not a chance. That's why we need to take off. But interestingly enough, this is a singular. And furthermore, the translation, "what can the righteous do?" Can do. That sounds like something potential, something for the future. It's looking the way that it's translated. Okay, what's the prospect for the future? Interestingly enough, the Hebrew Bibles, the editors have suggested that as a translation. They don't know what to do with it. So they suggest a future tense. But this is a past tense. So the way that this should be rendered is, what has the righteous one done? In other words, they're saying, well, God let this whole mess develop. God isn't doing anything. David, that's why you need to flee to your mountain as a bird. Because God hasn't done a thing. You're out there on your own, and we've got to make ourselves safe. I have to tell you something about translators. Translators tend to do a pretty good job most of the time. 95% of the time, they do a wonderful job. But all you have to do is get a little mixed up and have a little difficulty and say, okay, this passage has to make sense. And what do? You improvise a little bit. I'll tell you about a translator of the Hebrew Bible into Greek that had an interesting difficulty somewhere in the Minor Prophets. There was this whole list of names, names of people. And there's no such thing as capitalization or anything like that in Hebrew, so you have no way of recognizing immediately whether you're looking at names or common nouns or sentences or what you're looking at. And this translator tried to make sense of the passage. So he was creating words and trying to make sense out of this list of names. Now, can you imagine what it would be like to read that translation and have someone say, would you please read such and such a chapter, and here's this person just reading this thing, and it's an entirely different concept than what was going on. That's the problem that translators run into. As soon as something starts going wrong, it's like the soldier that starts marching right, left, right, left, right, left, instead of left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, and he's out of step the whole way through. And that is what has happened right here. Translators in this passage have had a difficulty, and they didn't know how to resolve it. So look at all the problems that were created. First, there's a punctuation error, so they have the wrong people speaking. And then, after that, they think that David is saying, well, okay, what can the righteous do? And then we as English readers, since they didn't capitalize righteous, we're thinking, okay, what can righteous people do? And instead it's, okay, David, what has God done? And the idea that's here is, God hasn't done a single thing. Can you imagine how many people said that during the Depression? And how many people today are shaking their fist at God and saying, God, you haven't done a thing. Look at what you let happen. Story that I've told before. There was a man whose testimony of why he became an atheist I read one time. And this man said, my mother prayed for Sandy Koufax that he would win every game. Well, Sandy Koufax won a lot of games. And the boy thought that that was pretty good. Then he got older and he found out about the Holocaust. And he said, the same God that was answering my mother's prayers for Sandy Koufax to win his games let 6 million Jews die in the Holocaust. He said, I don't have any use for God. That's essentially what his advisors are telling him. You can't trust God when it really gets bad. Well, David has an eloquent answer. Oh, by the way, you will notice here that some of the translations do have it a little better. Darby's translation says, for they have destroyed the things which thou hast made, but what has the just man done? He thinks it's men. But at least he recognizes its past, and he recognizes it's singular. The Geneva Bible, for the foundations are cast down, what has the righteous done? The reader there might still think righteous is plural, and they won't think God since it's not capitalized. Jewish Publication Society translation says, when the foundations are destroyed, what hath the righteous wrought? Again, it doesn't make it clear that it's talking about God. Brenton, in his translation from the Greek Old Testament, for they have pulled down what thou didst frame, but what hath the righteous done? Young's literal translation, when the foundations are destroyed, the righteous, what hath he done? Perhaps a little clearer, but notice they aren't making it clear that this is God that they are speaking of. Okay, let's now look at David's response. Starting in verse 4. David says, God is doing what he's always done. God is watching over history. So in verse 4, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids test. the sons of men. God is there, and he is evaluating planet Earth. And we know how there are many times when God has intervened. When we were in Genesis, we saw how God intervened with the flood. We saw the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain. And we can go through our Bibles, and we do see that the God who is watching does, at times, intervene directly. But God is always in control. In verse 5, we have another punctuation issue. And it comes down to understanding what certain words mean. In verse 5, the Lord tests the righteous. But the wicked and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. Now, some translations will handle this in different ways. Notice, the New American Standard reads, the Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. Whereas the New King James, the Lord tests the righteous, but the wicked and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. So the question is, which verb does the word wicked belong with? Well, the meaning of the word tests tells us which is correct. This is the word for testing when you're trying to find out how well something can perform instead of trying to make it fail. Now, we all have seen on television when they have tests of two competing products. Shall we say brand A and brand B? And you know that brand B is going to come out short. On the other hand, if the manufacturer of brand B does a test against brand A, they're going to arrange their tests in such a way that brand B comes out on top. And the testing that is being done here is the testing that the Lord does in order to prove or strengthen the character of the righteous. Remember how 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13 tells us that no temptation has overtaken us, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will with the temptation also provide a way of escape, that you may endure it. The concept is, God has not designed anything to break down and destroy the Christian. God has designed it so that we are able to draw upon his strength and to succeed despite how difficult the trial that we face. And the testing here is the Lord tests the righteous. He allows things to come into their lives in order to find out, will they trust the Lord? Now, let's think about it. The Lord gave David and his advisors the opportunity to pass their test. David's doing fine, isn't he? His advisors are in a test that they're supposed to be able to pass. You know, it's like the exam that's a sleeper, you know, that you're supposed to be able to pass. You know, everyone walks in and there's no problem at all. It's the type of exam that says, please sign your name, read all the instructions, and turn in the exam. And you have someone that's just writing away, and they're just going to town, and they haven't followed the instruction because they were supposed to turn it in after they read the instructions, and instead of handing it in, there they are filling out all the answers, and they think they're doing a great job, and instead they fail the exam. God has given a test that could be passed. David passed it, his advisors failed it. But it's God's grace that David was there to instruct his advisors and to let them find out that they would find God to be faithful, because God is testing them. Not to make them fail, even though so far they're not doing so well in this test. On the other hand, God is opposed to the wicked and to the one who loves violence. So in verse 6, upon the wicked he will rain coals. Fire and brimstone and a burning wind shall be the portion of their cup. When we resume the Genesis series, which I plan to do after we finish Thessalonians, at one point we'll get to Genesis chapter 19, and we'll have an interesting film for you to watch a portion of this. I mean, it's just really fascinating here on the brimstone and what that is like. I mean, that's really going to be something. It would come down like rain, and there's evidence that that's how it came down, but you have burning sulfur, and it just burned into the rock, and the evidence is left behind there in Sodom and Gomorrah. Just a fascinating thing to see the evidence that is left behind. And what this passage is telling us is God has severe discipline in time for those evildoers that he's needing to deal with. And their inheritance, the portion of their cup, what they can expect is discipline from God in time. The passage is not talking about eternal destinies. Some of the people may have been believers. But regardless, in time, David is saying there will be severe judgment upon them. If the time that's being spoken of is the rebellion of Absalom, Absalom died an ignominious death when he was there hanging from the tree with his long hair, and then ended up with David's rebellious general coming in and doing him in. But there was much that went on. The Lord does deal with the unrighteous. He deals with him in time. Isn't this a lot like what we saw as to how God is going to deal with the persecutors of the Thessalonians? There, as we looked in the passage, and he talked about where the unbeliever does not have that pre-trib deliverance, and they will not be spared from facing the tribulation and being on planet Earth through that time. God does repay in time. That's his standard plan. That's his standard operating procedure. And David is able to rely upon that. I'm sure David would have liked to have seen God deal with these adversaries sooner, but he knows that God is going to deal with them in the appropriate time. And David is able to rest in that confidence. Verse 7 explains why it is that God deals with people in the way that he does. He doesn't approach the righteous as though they're unrighteous, and he doesn't approach the unrighteous as though they're righteous. Remember how we saw that in verse 5, he is able to differentiate between how he deals with the righteous and how he deals with the wicked. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteousness. His countenance beholds the upright. God's focus is upon believers. God's focus is upon making things work out in the end for believers. Kind of sounds like Romans 8:28, doesn't it? God is in charge, and his focus is upon the righteous. But you know, it's an interesting thing. When we get into times of difficulty, we sometimes look at ourselves and say, why me? Why, Lord? Why are you letting me face this? Why do I deserve this? When we have a time of blessing, do we say, why me? I don't deserve this, do I? But when the times are tough, we tend to sometimes look at it from the standpoint, why me? And then we also, in times of adversity, start pointing our fingers at all the ones that we think God ought to get. But the way that God operates is different than the way that we think. God is looking at us, and he's saying, how can I help the righteous accomplish all that I have set before them? The Lord is righteous. So since he is righteous, he loves righteousness, and he focuses upon the righteous, upon the upright, upon the believer who is walking by the word in order that he can ultimately prosper that person. David is saying, better watch out, fellas, because God is getting ready to discipline all those that have created this turmoil here in Israel. And now what happens if we get sideways too? What happens if David and his advisors turn away from the Lord? Well, how many righteous people then does the Lord have to behold? Or is he going to have to bring discipline into the lives of those who were up to that point handling things correctly? I remember very clearly, I was a security guard at a nursing home. And this one evening, there was a supervising nurse. She was the charge nurse for the whole building. And there was a problem with one of the employees, and that's so they came down the elevator, and they were having a discussion. And the employee was going to be put on suspension, needing to go home. And things were going fine. They were going according to the book. And then the nurse's aide, who was in trouble, said something that just got this charge nurse's goat, and she just slapped her right across the face. Guess who was in trouble all of a sudden?
Charge nurse.
And so the assistant charge nurse had to come down, and both of the employees got relieved, sent home, and the charge nurse never returned ever again. David is saying to his advisors, so far we're in the right, but if I follow your advice and we ignore the God who is in control, that's not a good thing for us to be doing. How easy it is for us to get sideways in the times of difficulty. If we're going along and we're saying, okay, well, I'm seeking to follow the Lord, I'm going along, and then all of a sudden things kind of go wrong, and then it's very easy to get sideways. Very easy to start looking at things in the wrong way. David didn't select his advisors because they gave bad advice. He selected them because they were loyal. He selected them because they had good advice. But as everything is falling apart, he needs to be on guard with the Word of God. We need to pay attention to God's Word and what he teaches in it, even more than our most trusted human advisors. That is what David is telling us. God's character does not change. David knows this. And he knows that regardless of the circumstances that he faces in life, he's always going to be able to take refuge in the Lord. And he wants to make sure that his advisors are heading in the right direction too. Times like these are a wonderful time to consider a passage like this. Our economy has not bottomed out. But I expect we will see new crises and new problems. And we have a new team there in Washington that hasn't had a lot of experience in handling these things. They need our prayers. Because there are going to be temptations to do things in ways that might seem like the best route. They say the shortest route from A to B is a straight line. But sometimes what seems right to a man is absolutely wrong in the Lord's eyes. This is a time when we need to be praying for our national leadership. And as far as our own personal walk, we need to watch the Lord's word and take it as our most precious advisor. Society. Yeah, it's the everything that could be counted upon within the nation. You know, it's the justice system is perverted. You have people heading all different directions. It could be economic chaos. The times when there's going to be political instability and people are able to lodge attacks on the king, whether it be verbal or attempted assassination or an attempted coup or whatever, usually there are some other difficulties that are making it so that some of the people who could normally be trusted are saying, not so sure if I want to follow David. So, in other words, they're saying, if all the things that we thought we could count upon have fallen apart, what's left to protect us except Masada? What's left except a fortress that's impenetrable? That would, Masada would be normally taken as the referent for the mountain that they're urging him to escape to.